Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. On the programme today, we'll be chatting with Ossian Ward, Head of Content for the Listen Gallery, who's fresh off the plane from Shanghai. He'll be telling us about the smattering of new museums in the Chinese city that caught his eye, plus a brand new film by artist Ai Weiwei. We're also joined in the studio by the writer Mark Mason, who has a couple of non-fiction reads up his sleeve to recommend. As well as that, we'll be meeting the American singer-songwriter Jim White to hear about his new album, and of course we'll have this week's Global Countdown. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Ossian, Mark, welcome to the show, both of you. Ossian, we're going to start with you today. You've just got back from a trip to Shanghai. Tell us, first of all, what you made of the city's art and cultural scene. And had you been there before?
No, I hadn't, actually. And probably it will look different next time I go. I mean, it is one of the big mega cities. I don't know where it ranks in the top of the populated centres of the world. But in terms of the art, I think they're trying. So we, the Listen Gallery, were participating in art fair. They have two art fairs now at the same time, Westbund and Art 21, which is more, I wouldn't say, they're both international fairs, but Art 21 is more for local galleries and Shanghai and Beijing galleries to participate in. But Westbund is this area which is just a little bit off-centre where they're building museums, they have foundations. A lot of the museums are private foundations, so they're obviously owned by one person or a rich family, and then they're kind of, the program follows their taste. So yeah, I think it's all happening. They have the collectors, they have the galleries, they have the programs, they have the art fairs. You know, what's not to like, really?
And what did you think of the kind of the atmosphere? I mean, you mentioned that they're building a lot there. Does it feel like there's a lot of energy there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's kind of trying to encapsulate it or trying to work out where it's going to go next. So in this Westbund area, you have the Long Museum, which is, you know, it's kind of a proper museum standard. So they're showing Dutch old masters, which they've borrowed from a great collection in Leiden. So you can even see Vermeer and, you know, the like there, as well as Anthony Gormley, who pops up everywhere in their kind of next door museum. But the ticket price is not cheap. I don't know, 300 RMB. I'm not sure what that translates to as, but it's about 30 quid or, you know, 20 quid. So it's not cheap.
Hold the door, that's quite a lot, actually.
Yeah. So, and then there's the Yuz Museum, which is the kind of the friendlier one, but that's also nearby. And they've got a Shanghai sort of local contemporary art show, Shanghai Galaxy. They're all in these incredible, capacious buildings, the biggest of which is called the Power Station for Art, very dramatically, and is essentially the big kind of turbine hall, as you'd imagine, like Tate Modern, with the chimney. But it's kind of, I suppose the idea is that they show architectural and design shows as well as art, but it's kind of, it could do with more. I mean, I think that's one of the criticisms of some of the bigger Chinese museums, is they need better programming, they need more curation, they need, so, you know, that's quite a lot of what I think the Western galleries are doing. They're sort of providing content, providing shows, which is fine. But there were good shows. It's not that they're not doing that yet. And then there are the quirkier ones like K11. So you're in the mall. You've done your...
That's PS1 as well, is it? It's a collaboration with PS1?
Yeah. So the exhibition has come from New York, and it was called .com.cn. And it's a kind of post-internet show, which is, you know, perfectly serviceable and good and interesting. But what's the best thing about it is you have to traverse the mall to get there. So this guy, Adrian Cheng, who's set up the K11... It's a mall, but it's also now an art foundation. And one of the features of the Chinese museum building boom is that there are kind of branches or venues. So you have one mall in Shanghai. I don't know how many, you know, it's a huge skyscraper. And then in the basement, there's two or three floors just devoted to art, which is kind of amazing, as well as you have the gift shops, and you go through all the sort of the layers of retail, and suddenly you're in a kind of proper museum show. So that's the way it's going. You know, I think it's going towards these kind of experiential things. We wouldn't normally think of a mall as being a place to go and look at art, but that's increasingly what's happening in the Middle East and in China.
You mentioned that a lot of these museums are privately funded. What does that mean about, you know, for the content? I mean, is it very hit and miss for that reason, or is it very distinct? Each one has a very distinct kind of atmosphere and a very distinct flavour.
Yeah, I think sometimes you can get the collection display and be a bit disappointed and think, oh, that's what this person is, you know, collecting and owning, and that's not the best. But in terms of the imports, you can't fault them for their, you know, taste and for the reach, actually, because there's another interesting venue. It's called the Howe Museum, and it's part of a hotel. And it's Mr. Howe, who's also got another one in Wuzhou, or I can't remember what the other city he owns another one, but they're showing a kind of retrospective of Julian Rosenfeld, who I think you had on Monocle recently, talking about this big exhibition and this big work called Manifesto, which is, you know, it's a kind of serious, large-scale installation, as you would see in any museum in the West, and indeed that show has been touring a lot. So, no, it's not a problem with the content. I think some of it gets imported, if you like, but some of the better museums and galleries, such as the Rockbund Art Museum, have their own kind of program with Chinese art. So there's a version of the Hugo Boss Art Prize, but it's an Asian version of the Western Prize, and they're all young Asian artists. And that was, you know, that's what you want to see. You want to see them programming Chinese art as much as you want to see the Western imports.
And you actually also managed to get to Nanjing, which is not too far away from Shanghai. What did you see there?
That was really interesting. And again, it's a single owner, or actually it's his father and son owned private museum. It's called the Sifang Art Museum. But what they've done, which is clever, I mean, you know, the perfectly, again, interesting building designed by Stephen Hall, American architect, in this kind of mad shape that you kind of have to traverse, which is almost like a kind of floating gallery in the sky. But beneath all of that, they've commissioned their property developers, the father and son. So they've asked lots of famous artists and architects, including, I think it's Ettore Sottsass, like his last building, and Isozaki. There's actually an Ai Weiwei building, which I didn't know about. And then there's also a David Adjaye building. And they're sort of like follies in the landscape. So there's a giant park where you can kind of wander or take a golf buggy if you're lucky enough. And you can go and visit all these architectural follies. And they're all houses or small kind of retreats, but just set in the landscape. And it's incredible. So that's definitely worth a visit. They're still kind of, as is the case with China, they're still building and finishing it. And, you know, parts of these architectural wonders were built about 10 years ago, and some of them look like they need a bit of repair, but they're going to be open again soon. But the museum has kind of two or three shows a year, and then you have these kind of architectural things to go and see below.
Are there any galleries or museums high up in a skyscraper? Because I was in Shanghai nearly 20 years ago, and it was just astonishing the number of skyscrapers going up there.
Yeah.
And now whenever I've seen it on the news or, you know, whatever, a picture of it since then, it just seems one of the most vertical cities in the world. And it just struck me, if you were to put something like that at the top of a skyscraper, it would completely change the way you saw, if you were looking at the art with, yeah, you know, views of hundreds of miles beyond.
Yeah. That's certainly, I mean, that was the famous example of the Mori Art Museum in Tokyo, which did that. I can't remember, the 63rd floor or whatever it was on, which was quite spectacular. And what actually this developer, you know, this guy Adrian Cheng with the K11 Art Foundation is, I think that the art is soon going to, in his new next venues or his next branches, will sort of invert and become not in the basement, but will become sort of elevated, if you like, beyond the kind of retail floors. So, yeah, it's happening. It hasn't happened yet. I can't say that I went to something that kind of where the art and the landscape competed with each other in that way. But the Sifang Art Museum is a kind of elevated walkway, if you like, which you have to traverse in order to, and then you get great views.
Let's move on now and look at Ai Weiwei's new film, Human Flow, which you've just seen. It's a documentary about the global refugee crisis. Ossian, tell us a little bit about how and over what kind of timeline this film was made.
Yeah, so he's been travelling, you know, almost nonstop. So he was given his passport back by the authorities a few years ago. Then he immediately put on this Royal Academy exhibition. That was his kind of first bit of travel. And actually, since then, he's been kind of ceaselessly following this, as he calls it, human flow. So the action begins in Lesbos in Greece, where, you know, much of this first wave of, it said about a million or so people in 2015 crossing the Aegean Sea started in Lesbos. And there's a scene with Weiwei and his camera phone, which he takes everywhere, and he's always filming people on it. And you can kind of see the first people coming off the boats and, you know, him sort of trying to welcome them. And, you know, it's quite a sort of traumatic scene. But then That's something we're very familiar with. And actually, what happened was is that after doing that first bit of that encounter, he realized that what he normally does, he does film everything, and he has his studio assistants. They're always filming him as well, so it's kind of like cameras pointing everywhere. But he realized that what he was shooting was this kind of shaky cam phone footage, which wasn't going to basically do this subject any justice. So he went back to Berlin, kind of regrouped, hired proper documentary filmmakers, and then went back and started shooting. And then 23 countries later, you know, you have Human Flow, which is now getting its kind of worldwide release. And I think it will also have a kind of theatrical release as well as a kind of Amazon Prime release.
And does he succeed, I guess, in giving us a fresh view of the crisis? I mean, after all, as you said there, you know, we have seen plenty of images of refugees over the past 5 years and watched plenty of interviews and seen a lot of this footage already. Does he offer a fresh perspective on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's possibly the first time you're really going to sit and spend 2.5 hours with this subject. You usually get it in snippets and we see bits of these countries. But, you know, he's kind of gone all the way to Afghanistan, all the way to Syria, Jordan, Iraq, some of the places that we get glimpses of. And then even the places you think, you know, like Calais and, you know, even the Mexican border. You know, I think there's some places that get short shrift. So the Rohingya, which is obviously a big deal coming out of Myanmar and into Bangladesh, only get a couple of minutes. So you don't really get a sense of that particular crisis. But of all the other ones, you know, you also see the downtime in between. So you don't just see people coming off boats and people struggling to get on trucks. And, you know, you do, and you see the burning the camps and all the dramatic stuff. But you get the downtime in between. You get the boredom. You get the, what do we do? We're stuck in this, you know, 4x8 kind of cell. So you get the moments in between where people are just, yes, they're still traveling or they're trying to get somewhere, but they're kind of frustrated and they're not allowed to move, or their movement is impeded, or it's, you know, they can only get so far as the border with the big razor wire. You know, that there's these moments in between where you don't just get the dramatic paparazzi moment where, you know, people are there filming this action. You get the kind of the downtime and the sort of, that's the more human element of the story.
And he started, as you said, with this kind of shaky iPhone camera style. But in the final film, we have a lot of drone shots sort of soaring yeah. way above the people. And I guess that's where you see the human flow, the flow of human beings. Are those shots effective, do you think? Those drone shots from miles above?
Yeah, sure. I mean, they add to this epic sense of this kind of timelessness of it, that this has been happening forever. It's not a kind of current thing. But also what I like is it focuses on this weird architecture of displacement. So you get all these buildings that are built. You get the classic UN kind of white plastic boxes or tents that are there for people to kind of live in temporary shelter. But then you also get the jerry-built ones, the homemade ones, the mud-built houses, the kind of things just slapped together from corrugated iron and, you know, a shipping container. So you start to also see these different cities emerging, which are kind of contingent on these people's, you know, abilities to make the best of what is a kind of terrible situation. And, you know, these are not the official architectures. This is not Shigeru Ban or whoever creating beautiful but elegant solutions, or I think it was IKEA or someone, you know, you know, these are just, this is the kind of the reality of it. It's not the sort of, you know, it's not the official version of what this architecture should look like. So you do get glimpses into those kind of camps and to see what the kind of daily life is like. And yeah, I think that's valuable. It's adding that extra layer that we haven't got before.
Human Flow was released on the 20th of October in the US and will be out on the 8th of December here in the UK. Mark, let's move on to your book picks now. First up is 11 Explorations into Life on Earth, Christmas Lectures from the Royal Institution by author, documentary maker and marine biologist Dr. Helen Scales. Tell us, first of all, why you picked this book.
Because it's charming and it's lovely and it's interesting and there's lots of stuff in it that ties us back to when these lectures started. For those of you that don't know, the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures have been going since 1825. And every year they lecture to children, you know, a scientist is chosen to lecture to children on something to do with science. And they've been televised in recent decades. And They've picked out 11 of the lectures that focus on, well, the full title is 11 Explorations into Life on Earth. Normally it's physicists or chemists picking something from their subject, but these are biologists and people to do with, the living world. And it's fantastic. It's right from the beginning that the lectures pick up on that thing that we've always had, that human beings have always had, which is curiosity and the charm that there is in just incredible facts about nature. Going back, there's one of the early lectures from, I think, 1911, this one, saying that African elephants don't stop growing until they're 20 to 24 years old. But comparing that to cicadas, and they live for 17 years as larvae, and then they burst out and they're adults and they're flying around for just 2 months and then they mate and they die. So there's just incredible stories from nature all the way through it, and it's fantastic.
And what's amazing about this, I guess, is that it's not simply just a collection of essays, but also Dr. Helen Scales, who's the author, goes into how each essay was received at the time. So what kind of insights do we get, about the, I guess, the world that these lectures were spoken into?
Yeah, well, lots of them are to do with going back. There's a few pictures in there as well, and it's the little social things, like you say, the things that are different back then. There's a lecture from, I think, the 1940s, something like that, 1930s, maybe even just pre-war. And it's, as I say, it's always been done to children. And they're older children. You're not going to get 3- and 4-year-olds in there. They're sort of teenagers and early teenagers through to later ones. And they're all wearing suits and ties in that picture. So that social side of it is incredible. But like I say, what ties it all together is what, more than the similarity, more than the differences, are the similarities. And just that fascination, and also the fascination that the kids have with the live animals that are brought in to illustrate the lectures, and how that can sometimes go wrong. Because David Attenborough, who's done a foreword to the book, and also one of the lectures that's included from 1973 is his. They were broadcast on TV live in those days. These days they're recorded in advance. But he had a porcupine that he'd brought on live BBC TV, and the porcupine refused to come out of its cage, so he had to entice it out with a banana. And then that happened in 2004 as well. Sue Hartley was giving her lecture that year, and she'd got a sloth. It is sloth, not sloth, isn't it, the animal? You pronounce it sloth?
I don't know. I think you can go either way.
It's one of those...
I've always said sloth, but...
Have you? Actually, no, you're right. You've got me doubting myself. Yeah, let's go with sloth. She's using a sloth in her lecture, and the sloth in rehearsals, according to the book, was, I quote, quite active. Now, I don't know what quite active is for a sloth, but still. But when it came to the filming, this thing just crawled to the side of the stage and refused to move. And so she was left with the director in her ear shouting, "All I can see is its arse!" So there's, as well as the information in the lectures itself, you've got the joy of just thinking about all these kids there, witnessing this sort of thing going on.
And you mentioned at the beginning that it covers 150, almost 200 years of lectures. It must be amazing to see how our relationship to the natural world has changed over the past century. I mean, what are some of the big differences between, the late 20th century or even later and right at the beginning?
Yeah, there's the little things like what they used to call things. Apparently the bumblebee used to be called the humblebee. And I was hoping for a footnote there to explain why it was called the humblebee. Was it something to do with they thought it looked humble? Bumblebees always look quite arrogant to me. I don't think it would have been. But anyway, for whatever reason, that the name change came around. And obviously in recent years, they're talking about one of the more recent lectures was about the problems with Antarctica, the rise in global warming and the problems it's causing. The little stuff very often is the most fascinating. The big stuff is quite hard to get your head round, and or it's not going to make for such interesting copy, in that we know that global warming is going on. Of course, it's a massively important subject. How are you going to make that interesting to children? That's a bit of a challenge. What is lovely is the stuff that they can instantly appeal to. As from Attenborough's own lecture, the one I mentioned in 1973, he told us that blackbirds in the UK have regional accents. Experts on blackbirds can tell you which part of the UK a blackbird is from the way it sings.
Because his lecture is all about communication between animals, isn't that right?
Yeah, and...
Could you do a Geordie blackbird?
That would be a very different song by the Beatles, wouldn't it? I don't actually, incidentally, I found out the other day, complete coincidence, isn't it strange how these things happen when you're reading a book and then you find out that the reason that, on Blackbird by the Beatles, the actual blackbird that comes in at the end, the little soundtrack of the blackbird singing, was because one of the sound engineers at EMI, where the Beatles used to record at Abbey Road, had recorded it in his garden. He'd had all this equipment from EMI, and he just happened to have it in his garden. So then they decided to put it onto the record. So, yeah, I would assume that was a St. John's...
A very good southern
Blackbird. A southern one, yes, because he lived out in Middlesex, I think, this guy. So it would be RP, whatever the RP is for blackbirds. And then there's the stuff going all the way back, that we've always been fascinated with dinosaurs. I remember my son's 8 now, and he's several times at primary school already, they've done dinosaurs in projects. And I was doing it 40 years ago when I was his age. We've always loved dinosaurs. And recently, the 1996 lecture, Simon Conway Morris was doing this lecture, and he was talking about the Brachiosaurus. I'm reading it, just to go back to your point about how things have changed. This is 1996, which feels relatively recent, but I remember reading a couple of years ago in the newspaper that scientists have... more recently than that, I think it was this year. Scientists have now changed the way they think dinosaurs look. They now think that dinosaurs were a lot slimmer than we'd previously thought, because, of course, no one ever sat there and sketched a dinosaur. We're doing it all from the fossils that we find. But anyway, back in 1996, he was talking about the Brachiosaurus and explaining that it needed two hearts. Because the Brachiosaurus, one of those tall ones with a very long neck, to pump the blood all the way up its neck to its head, it needed a very, very powerful heart to do that bit of the pumping. But if it had used the same heart to pump the blood, for instance, to its lungs, which are down at near a ground level, it would have burst its lungs by forcing this blood at it with such force. So it had to have two hearts, one that pumped it really forcefully and one that pumped it much more gently at a lower level. It's incredible. It's a great book.
11 Explorations into Life on Earth, Christmas Lectures from the Royal Institution, is out now and is published by Michael O'Mara Books. Mark, your second book today is Michael Rosen's So They Call You Pisher, a memoir. Tell us a little bit about this and why you picked it.
I picked it because he's always fascinated me, Rosen, ever since I read about 5 years ago. I'd always been aware of him, but about 5 years ago, when my son got into this sort of story, we read So You're We're Going on a Bear Hunt, which is one of Rosen's many children's books. And I didn't really get it. I mean, I was charmed by it, but I couldn't see why. It's very short, as a lot of those children's books are. And at the end of it, I won't spoil it for anyone that's going to read it to their child.
They'll die.
But at the end of it, I could sort of see why I think people were fascinated, but not quite as much as my son was and millions of kids have been. It's an incredibly successful book. So I've always been fascinated by him because even when I don't... Andrew Lloyd Webber's another one. I don't particularly like it. Well, I don't like Andrew Lloyd Webber's music at all. But Phantom is such a massive success. I'm always fascinated by what people find interesting. Now, I like Rosen's work more than Lloyd Webber's, I have to say. And so I was fascinated to read it. It's just his autobiography, essentially, of concentrating on his childhood growing up. He was born in 1947, grew up in northwest London, and it's the story of his family. It's much more about his family in the end than it is about him, and talking about Jewish relatives that had escaped and come over. And so there's a fair bit of social history in there, but there's a lot of charming personal stuff as well.
And when do we end, I guess, the memoir? Because it's not his whole life. It doesn't take us up to the present day. Where does he end up, Michael Rosen, at the end of this?
It's sort of, like I say, it concentrates mainly on his childhood, goes through to him going to Oxford and his start of his adult career, and goes into that. And then the very end of the book, there's a very detailed bit about his family and how they'd come over here, and lots of the stories about what the Nazis had done to members of his family over in Europe. But that can be quite chilling, bits of that. But the most charming bits, like I said, the bits when he's seeing all this stuff coming through, looking back on it now with his adult eyes, he's seeing what in his childhood eyes was these very naive way he had of seeing things, and all these events seen with a different light looking back on it. And also the stuff about just how different Britain was back then and how horrible the school was, for instance. Even at that age, he knew that some of his teachers were monsters and would beat them and use corporal punishment, which now would literally be illegal and back then was the norm. And he and his classmates had a fantastic way of getting back at one particular teacher who beat them. They would indulge in invisible humming. So they would all hum with their mouths closed, everyone in the class. But because the teacher couldn't tell who it was, the teacher couldn't, unless the teacher was going to beat the whole class, which even that teacher wouldn't have done. It's a very, very clever and subtle way of getting back at the teacher. So I loved him for that.
And it's interesting, Michael Rosen, who's famously a children's writer, his whole career has been built on looking through the eyes of children at things. Is it interesting that then, he's going back to his own childhood and looking at how he might have looked at things as a child?
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same, I guess, the same skill.
Absolutely. That's it. There's always those different layers of things. And he knew, even as a child, I think he was culturally aware enough to know not to take culture too seriously. And he and his brother, his father was massive on Shakespeare and was always talking about Shakespeare to them. And he and his brother remember laughing at a book that their father had introduced them to called What Happens in Hamlet, primarily because it was longer than Hamlet. So he's always had an eye for this sort of stuff, which, in fairness to his father, he did also get from his father as well. His father took them to see Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. And as they sat down and Juliet appears for the first time, his father went, "That Juliet's quite broad in the beam." And it turned out that Juliet was Judi Dench. So again, when he didn't know that at the time, you look back on it. Yeah, it's really fascinating how these different layers of perception come through at different ages.
Does he ever explain the bear hunt? Do you get to the bottom of that?
Sadly not, no. Oh, that's the only, that in, you've rumbled me. That was the only reason I read it. No, there's no explanation to the bear hunt, but I'm sure that's going to be the volume two.
Yeah.
Michael Rosen's So They Call You Pisher, a memoir, is out now and is published in the UK by Verso. Mark, thank you for your book recommendations today. Now we're moving on to music. From most other musicians, the release of an album entitled Waffles, Triangles and Jesus would seem a deviation into eccentricity. Most other musicians, though, are not the California-born, Georgia-based Jim White, whose previous works have included Transnormal Skipperoo, Drill a Hole in That Substrate and Tell Me What You See, and, of course, Wrong-Eyed Jesus, The Mystery Tale of How I Shouted. White's new album is another splendid collection of country gothic oddness. He came to Midori House and told Andrew Muller all about it.
Drift away, hey, hey. I'll drift away, hey, hey. Drift away, hey, hey. I'll drift away.
My first question, Jim, is inevitably about the title. It's one of those question-begging titles, Waffles, Triangles and Jesus. Waffles and Jesus, I think the appeal of each is fairly readily understood, but Triangles?
Well, I never really know why I'm naming a record what I name it until after a couple of years, and I haven't figured out why I named it that yet. When I was probably 26 years old, I was working in a restaurant in New York, and Tom Waits came in. It was a quiche restaurant, and I thought, you know, damn it, if he orders quiche, I'm never going to listen to another Tom Waits. And to his credit, he humped and walked out. And he walked across the street, and there was a homeless man that lived across the street who claimed he was Hank Williams' illegitimate son. And he had a couple of teeth and a guitar with one string on it, and he would make these grunting sounds and busk. And he was mentally ill. And Tom Waits went over and started talking to him, and it made me really happy. And then Tom Waits pulled a notebook out of his pocket and started taking notes, sat down next to the guy and talked to him for an hour and took notes. Because the guy believed that he had been commissioned by the Postal Service to do a series of postage stamps based on paintings of hell, like by Bruegel and people like that. And
okay.
He was a crazy guy, and Tom Waits was taking notes. So the next day I went out, I bought a notebook, and I started taking notes. And I've got stacks and stacks of them at home, and I just go flipping through them sometimes. And one time I opened it up, and on one page was Waffles, and then on another page was a picture of a triangle and Jesus. And I said, okay, well, those need to go together, Waffles, Triangles, and Jesus. And it's been in a book for 20 years, and all of a sudden, when I was making this record, it said, this record needs to be called that.
Does that happen a lot with your songwriting, though? Not just the album title, but the songs that go on it, that there is just an idea that has been percolating in your head for however many years, and for whatever reason, at that particular point, when you sit down to write a song, it just happens to rear up?
Oh, I get all different kinds of songs. There's gift songs that just come all at once, and usually those come to me at the flea market. On this record, that's Ernest T. Bass, Alas Finds the Woman of His Dreams, and Playing Guitars, and Reason to Cry. Those are all flea market songs that came pretty much instantaneously. And then other songs, they're breech births. They come slowly and painfully, and you know, you just have to devote whatever amount of energy the song is asking for when you're creating it.
I did want to ask about Ernest T. Bass, Last Finds the Woman of His Dreams, because it's called E.T. Bass, yeah. At least on the album that I had. And I did look up E.T. Bass, because,
right.
You know, I do my research. And the only E.T. Bass I could find was an electrician in Folkestone, and I'm guessing that that's not him?
No, he's a hero of mine, the electrician in Folkestone. The way he conducts electricity. No, Ernest T. Bass was a recurring character, a minor character on the Andy Griffith Show. In the 60s, there was the Beverly Hillbillies, which is the comedy, mm-hmm. and the Andy Griffith Show, which was kind of the sweet drama. E.T. Bass was a maniac. The show was very genteel, except for his presence. He would show up every once in a while and drive this peaceful little town of Mayberry crazy. And I identified with him. I felt like I would probably grow up to be more like E.T. Bass than any of the sane Southerners there. And at a certain point, I wondered, in just thinking about him, I wondered, well, I wonder whatever happened to him, as if he were real. And I imagined him finding a woman of his dreams, and then I had to figure out what she was like. But the whole idea came when someone was walking next to me at the flea market. And there was a vendor at the flea market with a young woman with blue hair. And a guy walking next to me in a perfect E.T. Bass voice said, "I don't hoe with that blue hair." And it made me so happy. I wrote it down, and by the time I had walked three more aisles, I had the whole song in my mind. I changed it to Blue Eyes. So the first line, "I don't hoe with them blue-eyed girls." And it's E.T. Bass finding the woman of his dreams. She's a salty, rough-and-tumble woman who doesn't trust anybody and is just as crazy as he is.
Playing guitars, playing guitars, the whole dang world is playing guitars. Friends come calling from near and far, every last one's toting up a playing guitar. Them guitars go.
You mentioned the other flea market song there, as you put it, playing guitars, which is a song that really leaps out of the album. It just seems a genuinely quite exuberant and joyful moment. And it's not surprising, I guess, to learn that it came quite quickly. But what was that another one? It just popped into your head entire and there it was.
Well, I played a show the night before I was at the flea market, and I was standing outside, and there was a poster with my face on it, and I was holding a guitar. And I was looking at it thinking, you know, I'm holding that guitar like it's like a fetish or something. I need to not hold a guitar like that. And then I looked to the next poster, and there was someone else, and they were holding a guitar, and someone else, and someone else, and someone else, and someone else. And all the posters had people with guitars. And I went to the flea market the next morning. There was guitars for sale everywhere, and I thought, we have an unacknowledged epidemic of guitar playing in our country. Then it occurred to me that it needed to be addressed with a public service announcement in the form of a song, like The Clash with her. This is a public service announcement. So that's just me making sure that people are aware that there is an addiction issue with guitars in America, and we need to do something about it.
Moving seamlessly along then, I guess, to the nation that you hail from, and which I'm now going to, you know, hold you to account as a representative of in all its vast and diverse sprawling glory.
Yeah.
Is it actually quite hard at the moment not to write, obviously, about what's happening in the United States?
Well, the American politics has such a vast gravitational field now that everything gets sucked into it. It's like a black hole.
Yep.
You know, if anything comes within a million miles of the subject matter, it gets sucked into the political commentary. And, you know, we're in a time, I'm a Hegelian, so I believe that there's thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. And I think Americans are synthesizing a lot of big information right now. And I think good things are going to come from it. People are really awake. I've never seen people so awake. And some of them are awake, crazy, conservative, angry. And some of them are awake, crazy, liberal, angry. And then the people in the middle are smart. You know, on both sides of the argument. I grew up in a place where everyone has gone crazy. And I talk to them on Facebook all the time. They're good people. They just were raised different. And they have a different point of view.
You're still based in Athens, Georgia, is that right?
Yeah.
Which is, I've been there a couple of times. I know it very slightly, but it is, I guess, kind of anomalous in that it is a southern town, but it is also a liberal college town to a very large extent.
Wildly anomalous.
Is it important to you in terms of the way your records get made?
Athens, Georgia?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of amazing musicians there. I don't have to go looking for people to collaborate with. I don't have to fly to L.A. or New York or any place. I just pick up the phone and someone's over at my house. Like Holly Golightly lives about 10 miles from me.
Who does appear on the new album.
Yeah, and if you don't know her, she's this crazy British, maverick rocker. And she, you know, she lives down the road. And just call, hey, Holly, come over. The guy who mixes my records has Grammys all over his wall, John Keane. And he sings and plays guitar on the record a bunch, too. It's an amazing town. I'm traveling with, my backing band is Cicada Rhythm. They're a phenomenal kind of like a husband-wife group, like Milk Carton Kids or something like that. And they're part of this incredibly vibrant scene. So everywhere you turn, there's a musician. There's 242 bands in a town of 40,000. And nobody goes to any shows because everybody's in five bands. And you know, it's like, yeah, come to my show. It's like, sorry, I've been to 8 shows this week already, just supporting my friends.
But for all that, Athens is an anomaly. If you are identified as or identifiable as, especially now, for the reasons we were just discussing, as a specifically Southern artist, do you end up always having to feel like there's some kind of obligation upon you to explain that part of the United States, either to the rest of the United States or to the rest of the world?
I did used to feel that way. I don't worry about it too much anymore. I think as you get older, you have more faith that things are going to work out. When you're young, you jump up and down and get excited a lot, and you worry. I think things are going to be fine. And that's not Pollyanna. That's a lot of experience watching how things come and go. So no, I don't apologize too much anymore. I'm saddened by what the world is seeing from us, but I know that it's a necessary evil to let out of the box, because once it gets in the light of day, evil generally withers.
What can you say? But hey, 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 well, here I am. Can't lose your mind trying to find your way to some promised land. Between what's here right now and what might be there up then.
Jim White there, and his new album, Waffles, Triangles and Jesus, is out now on Loose Music. Now, as usual, it's time for the Global Countdown with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, where he will give us an in-depth look at the charts of a specific country. Faye, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Where are we heading this week?
We're going to the Netherlands again. I think it was one of the first Global Countdowns I've done, and it was such an interesting one because we could see that they do like their hip-hop, and not only American hip-hop, but Dutch hip-hop. And the top five is only hip-hop. That's amazing. I don't think there's a country, even the US is not as popular as that. But and quite a lot of different ones as well. So it's not only one guy that is kind of the main star of the moment. There's quite a few spread out, women, men, different ages. But I even texted a friend, do you know that the Dutch love hip-hop? And he's Dutch himself. And it's like, yeah, I mean, we have a scene since the 80s, a very strong scene. So yeah, it's a very interesting one.
Interesting to hear that. Okay, let's start with the countdown. We'll start with number five, shall we?
Yeah, number five is the only non-Dutch act. Is American rapper Post Malone and featuring 21 Savage with Rockstar. I think this is the number one song in the US at the moment. It's done very well here in the UK as well. I think it's quite a good song. And Post Malone, he also is influenced by other genres of music, like country music as well. So it's quite an interesting one. Moving on to number four, we have 7 Alias featuring Lil Klein and Buff. Buff is super famous in the Netherlands. I think he was born in France, though. He's from Algerian origin, but he's been living in the Netherlands since as a young age. And the song, excuse my Dutch, but it's Patser Gedrag.
That's pretty good.
That was fantastic. I insist you do that again. Come on, that was
I will. Patser Gedrag.
Amazing. You've got the Dutch G down, yeah.
Exactly. And I had some problems translating. When you translate to English, it's basically patter behavior.
Okay.
It's an interesting one.
Slightly meaningless, I think, in English as well.
That's the best song to dance in a dance floor as well, from the top five, as well, if I may say.
Okay. When you say Boeuf is French-born, is that his nickname, Boeuf? Because that means beef. Is it spelled the same?
I believe it's his... Yeah, B-O-E-F. So I guess that's
There's a missing U.
Maybe he made it more Dutch. You know,
exactly.
He's not related to Frank LeBeuf, who used to play for Chelsea.
No. Number three, we have Funk Louise with Op Me Mommy. She's a very young rapper. I believe she's around 18. And of course, I didn't understand exactly what she was saying. But in the video, she's in a supermarket, and there's a lot of kind of cartoons. I mean, I think she was very influenced by K-pop in a way. But the sound is not K-pop, but the looks definitely are. You know, and it's nice to see, like, you know, a young female rapper as well in this chart, which is quite male-oriented, actually. Number two, we have a band from Rotterdam, which is, again, one of the main hip-hop centers in the Netherlands. It's called Broederliefde with Officiel, which is... Official? I think I've done a French accent. Yeah. I'm really no, sorry, guys.
Don't say that. You had us until that. If you hadn't said that, we'd have been believing you.
So you've got to say it with confidence, and then you're absolutely fine.
Exactly. And again, the video clip for that song, it looks very expensive. It looks like what something, you know, what Jay-Z would do or something. So clearly they have the budget and the money to do those sort of things. But I guess you're curious for number one,
absolutely.
Right? We have a clip of it, actually. Let's hear it.
Want je ramen liefde voor de hand, daar strips overseas, maar betaal niet met je bankpas. Terwijl ik niet in het land was, voel je best vies, weet dat ik jou van mijn hand was. En ik kan dat, dus ik doe het ook. Charlie was het open, jullie mannen spenden roekeloos. En ik moet het maken, moet het pakken, nigga, hoe dan ook. Ben een dom daar met een fucking volle schoenen dood. Yeah. Wist je nog die tijden in mijn studio, yeah. Speel me kaarten goed, dit is geen Yu-Gi-Oh, yeah. We better than this, everybody knows this. Je bent niet goed, kijk wie mij vervloekt.
Did you like it? Before I say who it is.
There were one or two words in there that weren't Dutch, I suspect. I think I heard one or two rather rude words.
Oh, yeah.
It's got that kind of Afrobeat style like Jay Huss or someone like, you know, the British equivalent would be.
No, absolutely. And I think they again, they are also very young. I believe that's one of their first singles. It's Frena and Dikenza. I think they're two different rappers doing like a special duo there with the song, again, Verfluckt, which means cursed in Dutch. And what I like also about that song, I love short songs. I do have to say that. It's about 2 minutes and 50 seconds. I think sometimes it is the secret of a great pop song.
It's amazing that four out of the top five are, local. You know, they're from the Netherlands.
Not only hip-hop artists, but also Dutch, which is very difficult to find in a chart. So they do like their local artists as well.
Thanks very much.
It's a very good chart.
Thanks very much, Faye. Well, that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks very much to my guests, Mark Mason and Ossian Ward. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and I'm Matt Alagaya. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, let's play out with some more of that number one track from Frenna and Dikenza. This is Verfluckt. Thanks for listening.